from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour has been made in the past 2 weeks on Wall Street with some of the wildest swings we've seen in a decade. And if it feels something like 2007 and 2008, well, CBS News has a story this morning with this opening line, quote, "Fears of a U.S. recession have been mounting, with Wall Street appearing to be headed for its worst December since 1931. Yes, during the Great Depression," end quote. We are invoking the Great Depression now? Well, in some ways, the market has been historically due for a correction, but in other ways, it's fair to ask just how strong the economy is. What makes for a strong economy anyway? Unemployment numbers are low, but what about other fundamentals? How are earnings? How are wages? What have we seen with economic development nationally? And what about here in Western New York? How do we actually think the economy is doing in reality? Forget all the spin that you hear. It's kind of a year in review and a look ahead with our guest this hour. Anna List is Managing Director of Greater Rochester Enterprise. Anna, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Amit Badabiel, the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. Did I remember that correctly?
Absolutely. Thank you for having
me. You get the title, you get it on the air. Professor,
sounds
welcome
good.
Back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
George Conboy is Chairman of Brighton Securities. And George, welcome back to the program to you.
Always glad to be here, and thanks.
All right, so you're always the guy who's telling us calm down about the wild swings in the market, but it's been sort of wild for 2 weeks. Do you want us to calm down?
Oh, it's been wild for 2 months.
Yeah.
It's been a very exciting time, and many people, myself included, have all the excitement we could stand the last couple of months.
Do you want us to calm down then? Do you think we should? Or is it high blood pressure sort of a natural byproduct here?
So think about this, right? When you say calm, you imagine there must be some excitement, or you wouldn't say you should be calm.
Right.
Excitement implies emotion. Emotion is the worst thing you can bring to your investments. So to the extent you can wring emotion out of your decision-making, you'll be better off. To the extent any person can wring emotion out of their decision-making, they must be Mark Zuckerberg, because everybody else is human. I'm riffing on your
point.
That
is a good callback, George Conboy. That's very good. So whenever I get emotional, I'm just going to think the Conboy way is say, it's fine. Everything is fine.
Well, where you stand depends on where you sit. So you quote some numbers. We might have the worst December in umpteen years or what have you. So before I came in, I made some notes, because since I'm the ancient geezer in the room here, I have to have notes to rely on. And I looked at where the markets are this year. Now, all the major indices, the Dow, the S&P, and NASDAQ, they're all in red ink for the year.
Yeah.
But not terrible. Low single digits for Dow and Standard & Poor's. If you want to dial back to the end of 2016, so go back 2 years, we're still considerably ahead. So, do we get upset about a day, a month, a quarter, a year? I don't know. Everybody has a different yardstick, but there's no easy answer about when you should get upset, and that probably says you shouldn't.
All right, so before I turn to the other guests, just on that point, I mean, I take the point that it's easy in the short term to say things are way down, but you can go back a year, you go back 2 years and say, you know, okay, it's relatively placid, even up a little bit. I think the concern folks have is, does this portend a really dark 2019? And trying to time the market has always been sort of a fool's errand. I'm not calling you a fool. I'm calling myself a fool. That's why we turn to people like you. But trying to time the market is always difficult. But I think there's real concern that something portends darkness ahead here. Do you feel that way?
No. I'll tell you why. Because just about everything I read in the media, well, that's where you read, I suppose. Everything I read and everyone I talk to suggests that 2019 is going to be a disaster. Now, in nearly 40 years in business, I've seen disasters and lots of ups and downs. I have yet to ever see one accurately predicted by broad consensus. So if everyone thinks 2019 is going to be terrible, I'm thinking maybe not so bad.
Okay. All right. I like that. I'm here for the optimism. I am here for it, George Conboy. Let's turn national and then we'll turn local. Amit Badabiel, how do you view about the picture on the sort of the state of the economy nationally right now?
I think generally it's pretty strong, but we do have some unpredictabilities, primarily emerging from international events. So what I mean by that is, the EU economies, certainly the countries that use the euro as a common currency, their growth is slowing. And in addition to that, China's growth is also slowing. And compounding that, we have events like Brexit, which may really destroy the European Union, or at least be the beginning of the destruction of the European Union. And we've never had anything like Brexit. So the market really doesn't know how to deal with something like Brexit. So that's one key point. International activities are likely to...
Was that you? How many times, George Combo, have you been on this program?
Oh, so awful that should happen. It's the only call I want to take all day. It's a shipper bringing two old cars to my warehouse. Sorry.
You get one pass a year. Okay, Amit, go ahead.
All right.
It's okay. Go
ahead. We have these international activities which are, you know, hard to factor in into decision making because they've never happened before, and it's unlikely that anything like that will happen. And to that, I would add our president. I mean, the president is generally not supposed to rile the waters and, you know, increase unpredictability. But, you know, President Trump's actions do precisely that. I mean, his trade war with China, for instance, we don't really know exactly how it's going to end. The arrest of the Huawei representative, that's thrown a different monkey wrench. Now we find out that, you know, a lot of the hacking that has recently occurred with the Marriott hotels and others can be traced back to Chinese intelligence. So we're talking about unpredictability as a result of international events, compounded by the unpredictability of President Trump's actions, along with uncertainties introduced by things like Brexit. So how those things will actually play out is difficult to tell. Now, let me say this one obvious thing. A recession is going to happen for sure. That's just because of the nature of business activity, which is cyclical. The question is it going to happen in 2019 or 2020? I mean, the fact that it's going to occur is a probability one event. The only question is how soon. That's what all the, you know, worrying is about.
Well, then I would ask, if that's 1A, 1B is, the question would be is, how painful a recession? Because there are different flavors of recessions.
Right, right. So from everything that I can see so far, because of the strength of the U.S. economy, even if we set aside for the moment the international events that I just talked about, I think we may have something, but I don't think it's going to be of the nature of 2007, 2008. So in other words, not anywhere near as painful as what happened a little over 10 years ago.
All right. So in Western New York here, Annalisa, as managing director of Greater Rochester Enterprise, what are the fundamentals you look at to decide if you're feeling good about how the economy is moving here locally?
Well, personally, as a millennial, member of the largest segment of the workforce, I feel like, well, we've weathered that storm from 2008. Our generation did pretty well. And as a millennial investor, I follow the insights from professionals, and I keep my investments locked in, and I'm confident that if a recession happens in the near term or in the distant term, we'll weather the storm pretty well, just like we did about 10 years ago. Here in Western New York, what is impacting larger coastal hubs, metropolitan economies in California and even here in New York State and in New York City is actually benefiting Greater Rochester. We have a lower cost of living. We have it's an affordable market to do business. We have a low natural disaster risk. So where businesses are looking to make new investments, they're seeking out lower cost markets like Rochester. So a lot of our economic development successes in the last year have been because of businesses making relocation decisions based on those factors. So it's been a positive year. It's been the busiest year on record for my organization. We've had dozens upon dozens of wins and a lot of examples where we were competitive with California. We were competitive with Iowa, New Mexico.
Give me one
won.
That stands out. Give me a headline from the last year, one of the wins you're talking about.
Certainly. So a lot of activity in the optics, photonics, and imaging space, obviously, that I could cite. One right off the top of my head, in June, there was an announcement that American Packaging Corporation is expanding in Gates. That was competitive with Iowa, very competitive with Iowa, and it's creating 260 new jobs. The issue is, you know, access to skilled talent. Our unemployment rate is at a historic low at the moment. So employers have job openings on record right now, but they're having a difficult time filling those positions. And so that's where EDOs and workforce development organizations step up and try and connect training programs to employers that need talent. And that's not just an issue in Rochester. It's all across upstate New York.
All right, a couple of follow-ups that are wildly unrelated. So the first one is in regards to what you just said about employers and filling positions. Mm-hmm. We hear that a lot. We hear it from Rochester Works. We hear it from Bob Duffy. We hear it from GRE. And I'm not questioning the validity of that statement, but I'm wondering, you know, who are the companies? And we really do have these good-paying jobs that are sitting open and unfilled in the Rochester region?
Yes, absolutely. So just to rattle off a few examples of companies that are growing, yesterday we had that big announcement about the regional council. The Finger Lakes was announced as a top performer. companies such as OptiMax out in Wayne County. Bausch & Lomb is introducing a new contact lens manufacturing line. North American Breweries is expanding. NextCore is booming over at the Sibley building. A lot of startups are growing over there. Employee Channel is a new company that relocated here from Silicon Valley through an RIT connection. Sidor Optics, Qualitrol, On Semiconductor. These are all companies that are looking for skilled technicians and engineers. And so we are needing to recruit more skilled talent to the market and retain graduates from RIT, U of R, ensure that the Monroe Community College pipeline is full, and we're making connections between those programs and companies. But again, it's a lot of technical skills that are needed.
And then when it comes to the housing market, I mean, certainly you're right to say that in Rochester, if property taxes are high, and comparatively, you know, we know they are, that you can get a lot of square footage for your dollar compared to a lot of other places.
Correct.
In this country. But boy, has it been a seller's market for the last 2 years. Really remarkable seller's market. We've seen homes, especially in coveted neighborhoods in the city of Rochester, in surrounding areas, going for well over asking. This has been going on for a while now. I haven't dipped back in the last maybe 3 to 5 months, but certainly just talking to people who work in it, it's been a seller's market. Now, if the Fed moves interest rates up, probably home prices go down. Is that generally right, George?
We'll say they moderate. Anna? Let's say that.
Okay. So that could impact home prices. But are you worried at all at GRE that one of these big jewels that you can present to people, companies that are looking at the Rochester area, okay, your property taxes are high, but you can get so much for your money. Mm-hmm. Is that changing at all here?
I wouldn't say. Well, so yes, to your point, over the course of the last 5 years, the market's really gotten quite tight and housing prices are up. But by a long shot, we're still very competitive with other more expensive cities and regions. Even looking at, say, Cincinnati or Pittsburgh, our home prices are lower. And again, to bring up the millennial point, largest segment of the workforce, born 1980 to, I don't know, 2000 or something like that, now starting families, buying houses, looking for markets that are affordable where they can pay off their student loan and get a mortgage, and Rochester still very much so falls in that category.
All right, George Conboy, what are the big headlines for you in terms of more of a regional economy?
Well, certainly locally in the greater Rochester area, a company name I would add to the list that Anna had is Harris. So a couple of big bits of news there. They're going to merge with L3, another defense contractor. They will create the sixth largest defense contractor. And although they are not headquartered here, they have 4,000 people in our area. And if you go online to look for jobs, you'll see tons of listings from Harris. That's a great, strong, growing situation. Flip side of that is Kodak keeps getting smaller.
Who is this?
Kodak keeps getting smaller.
Not familiar with Kodak.
Yeah, we're not going to spend any time on them. But that Harris is probably the best company story in our area, in my opinion.
Okay. But the headline, you know, that's one company. Is the headline from 2018 going into 2019 that from your perspective, you're happy with the state of the economy? You think that the regional economy is seeing the kind of growth that you want? Or are the winds more isolated and is the bigger picture struggling? What do you see?
Seeing the kind of growth that's reasonable, I think I'd say. Because we'd all like stronger growth in upstate New York, and we rarely see what we might want. But it's acceptable, it's reasonable. As you stated, the housing prices are still good. And in the last quarter or two, that hot real estate market has cooled down considerably, and we're seeing a little bit more inventory coming in. So economies correct themselves. I was just in Buffalo last weekend, and Buffalo is becoming a hot destination. And you think, why? We all thought it collapsed. If you think of 40 years ago. The fact is, if economies get slow, things get cheaper, people start looking around there, and as Anna says, companies start looking for lower costs. They look for no drama weather, and companies begin to move in. Economies start to come back up. Economies are self-correcting organisms, and we're seeing the correction benefiting our region.
I want to turn to Professor Badabiel, because one of the things that I think we've talked about in the past is trying to understand not just, you know, sort of big picture economy, but how it's actually impacting people who are working. So, okay, we have an unemployment rate that is pretty low right now, which I understand there's a difference between people who are not looking for work and people who are looking for work and how certain metrics are defined.
Right.
But even for people who are working, One of the things we're going to talk about, I don't know, maybe next week, maybe the week after, is a story that I was just sort of an observer on social media as a lot of people were debating the story about millennials and Gen Zers who are ghosting their jobs and job interviews, which means they get a job and then they just stop showing up, or they apply for a job and they're offered it and they don't even respond. And some of the younger workers, and we want to be careful not to overgeneralize, but some of the response has been, oh, I'm sorry. You know, workers have been treated poorly for so long, wages are down, and now you're upset that we're not going to put up with it. And there's a lot of layers and a lot of things to unpack there, and we're overgeneralizing. So we'll spend some time in the coming weeks on that story. But what it struck me as is, even if people are working, what do we know about wages? How good are we feeling about the fact that, okay, people have got jobs, but does that mean the economy is strong?
Yes and no. So let me explain that cryptic answer. So I think in general, a lot of people are concerned that even though there has been some wage growth, this wage growth has been very low, or stagnant is the word I hear often in the context of wage growth. So there has been some wage growth, but it has been relatively stagnant for large parts of folks in the income distribution, unless you happen to be in the top decile, that's the top 10th or the top quintile, the top fifth. There, folks are doing pretty well in terms of job growth, no question about that.
Wage growth, yeah.
Wage growth, that's mm-hmm. right. But again, you know, contrasted to that is the sentiment that maybe unemployment is at its natural rate. And if you buy that line of story, then, you know, you are going to be concerned about what you might do to potentially decelerate concerns about rising inflation. And I think that's one of the things that you're going to see at, what is it, approximately 40 minutes from now when the Fed makes its announcement about what it's going to do to the Fed funds rate. So we have two sides to think about. One, yes, there has been some wage growth, but it's been stagnant for most folks unless they're at the top end of the income distribution. Contrasted to that is the concern about whether we are, in fact, at what economists call the natural rate of unemployment. Because if you try to lower unemployment below that, then you typically will have, typically, not always, rising inflation. So those are the two concerns that you have to think about in terms of determining what the net picture for wages. But there's no question that folks at the higher end are doing very well.
Okay. But for most of the rest of the working class, are you concerned? And are there any policy prescriptions that you sort of think are wise to consider about that?
I am concerned because when you deduct inflation and you look at what's happening to wage growth in general for people outside the top quintile, they are barely seeing increases. It's very, very slow. In fact, a kind of odd measure that one can look at, I was looking at it in the New York Times yesterday, even though unemployment is at a historical low, homelessness across the United States has risen by a small amount. Now, of course, there are all kinds of figures that one can look at in high-rent areas such as San Francisco, but I'm talking about the national picture. Homelessness has risen. So that's a bit of an odd statistic, but it does tell you that even though unemployment is supposedly at record lows, you still do have people who can't find a stable job and hence can't find a stable place to live in, and this is showing up in national statistics. In terms of your other question, in terms of what to do from a policy standpoint, it's a tricky issue. What I would suggest is that, you know, maybe the Fed should pause a little and figure out what to do in terms of its plan of action for 2019. In other words, it's announced that it's going to make a series of rate increases gradually and maybe hike the Fed funds rate to something like 3.5%. So it's now in the vicinity of 2.25%. So it should adopt a bit of a wait and see approach before it decides to say, you know, well, we're going to do this willy-nilly.
Okay. And is that, by the way, is that on the sort of the level of the step-by-step increases? Is that what you expect at 2 o'clock today?
I do expect an increase, yes, today. I definitely do.
And what should we expect the impact of that to be short-term here?
Well, it's going to tighten borrowing in general. It's going to increase borrowing costs. That's going to have a ripple effect throughout the economy, but not a significant amount because most of this has already been factored into the market. And the markets rose today, anticipating approximately 25 basis point increase.
Okay. George, are you concerned about an increase in the rate there?
No, I think I'd echo what Amit had to say, which is it's been baked in and it's expected. If they came out and said, we won't increase, or they came out and said, we're going to increase by 0.75%, then you'd see a shock in the markets, but you won't see that. But I want to go back to something you brought up and something Amit brought up that may be self-correcting. So the question is, are we at a natural rate of unemployment? Will people get raises that are a little bit more and enable a higher standard of living? So there's a clue in what you talked about. You're ghosting your job, you millennials. So you get a job offer.
Again, George, I was generalizing. I try to.
I understand.
Okay. All right.
But if someone gets a job offer and just doesn't show, what does that suggest? Because I'm guessing they're not ghosting their mortgage payment or their rent. They're not ghosting their car payment. So they have to do something to get some money. Maybe that means that you, employer, are not making an attractive enough job offer. If you get ghosted one time too many, you start raising the ante so that they show up and they get paid. And that's how economies help correct. You may have put two things together in that conversation.
Okay, interesting. I want to turn to, again, I love how Anna always points out millennials, largest segment of the workforce, right?
Yes, and larger than the baby boomers.
Okay.
In terms of size.
Are you concerned about these sort of this rising tide of anecdotal stories about job ghosting? I mean, what does that say to you?
No, because as our generation rises into positions of leadership, we're starting to kind of run the show. I mean, millennials are working in the newsrooms that are reporting out on those stories. So this ghosting issue, I think that's more of an issue in hot markets like San Francisco and San Jose and New York City, where you've got juggernaut huge tech firms competing voraciously for highly skilled engineering talent and making offers left and right. So there's a lot of job hopping that goes on in those markets. Here in Rochester, one of the benefits of this economy that we tout at GRE is that there's a lot more workforce retention here. In fact, Datto has reported that across all of their offices throughout the United States, they have the strongest retention rates here in Rochester.
Okay. Why do we think that is here?
I think because there's not as much opportunity in terms of magnitude when you're comparing us to the San Franciscos and the Washington, D.C.s of the world. But also, you've got much higher rates of home ownership among the younger workforce and just a sense of stability. People here are here, by and large, here to stay, unless you're in a PhD program or very early on in your career.
How do you feel about what we're seeing in terms of wage growth regionally?
So it's trending right along with national averages. Of course, wage growth is not as robust as it was decades ago. It is going up incrementally, and we're hopeful that that trend will continue. But that being said, I think, you know, Rochester has always been a really reliable market in terms of trending along with the national averages.
Okay. Listeners, I'll turn to you. If you want to email the program, it's connections@wxxi.org. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. How are you feeling about the state of the economy? How are you feeling about the state of the opportunity to find local work? How do you feel about if you have any money invested in the market? Are you mildly concerned with what you've seen recently? I didn't just invite George Conboy back because he was right about Bitcoin. But, you know, it was a year ago that you were the guy who was bearish on Bitcoin, I think it's fair to say, weren't you?
Well, I think I said something to the effect of, if you're buying something because it's going straight up, that's a bad reason to buy anything.
Yes. It was a year ago, it was almost $20,000 per coin, and now it's between $3,500 and $4,000 a coin. Still, if I'm going to use the George Conboy game, still way above what it was 4 years ago, 3 years ago, but massively down in a year.
So just after our show last year about Bitcoin,
yeah.
I was out in California visiting my son and daughter-in-law. And he said, "Dad, I bought some Bitcoin." And I said, "All right, how much?" And he looked at me and said, $200. So I
you, you went okay.
I didn't laugh, yeah. But I think of that, it's probably worth $40 now or $50. That's tuition, right? If he had put in a lot more, I'd be worried for the poor kid. But $200, you lose $100. If you lose it all, you learn something. That was a good little venture for him, I think. I don't think he'll be doing it again soon.
Are you still bearish on cryptocurrency?
Well, remember, what has happened since Bitcoin became big is there's this huge rush of competition
right. With
Litecoin and Ethereum and all the rest of that stuff. And it's a little bit of a confused market now, and it has not become a medium of exchange. It remains a theoretical store of value and a trading vehicle, but it was designed to be a medium of exchange, and except for some small volume of transactions, it is not.
I promise we're not going to divert into Bitcoin for the hour, but I will say this. I know I'm going to get emails from people who are involved in the blockchain community, and they are going to try to tell me, and I will listen, But you can use it more often. You can buy a sub with it.
Get a shift card.
And you know what? I'd love to know, because I think one of the points George is making here is if you all thought this was going to become an actual currency, not just an investment, it hasn't. You can't really go out and use Bitcoin too often. And maybe, again, that will change, or maybe you can use it in more places than I thought. So go ahead and email me and sort of, if you want to correct that point, that's fine. I do, Ahmed Badabiel, have a curiosity about the devoted crypto community worldwide isn't just into it for sort of like, for sort of speculating reasons. They believe that there's world economic collapse ahead and that this is the wisest thing to sort of backstop against that. Is that strange to you, or do you think that there's something mildly intelligent about always being on guard against? Because you just talked about Brexit and the possible ripple effect in the European Union and what the markets will do to that, and we don't know. Well, the crypto community is going to say, yeah, we're ready for that. It's going to be terrible.
Let me respond to you with an example that'll tell you how I feel about it. In 1930, John Maynard Keynes, arguably one of the most famous economists of all time, pondered a problem that he thought was, you know, going to be upon us fairly quickly. What is the problem? Technological unemployment. In other words, machines, digitization is going to take over our lives in such a way that we're going to have copious amounts of free time. And the problem for mankind, I should say humankind, mankind during his time perhaps, was going to be what to do with this extended leisure. Has that problem come to pass? So if one of the best and brightest minds could get an issue like that so profoundly wrong, I wouldn't put any money on the concerns of Bitcoin folks who think that, you know, the end of the world is nigh, their, eschatological zeal notwithstanding.
Yeah, what percentage of those emails you'll get will be from men ages 18 to 34?
All of them?
All of them.
Okay. Anna, do you own any Bitcoin?
No, absolutely not.
No, it wasn't just no, it was absolutely not. That was an interesting response.
My gut instinct when the trend took hold last year was that it would be a fad, and it just doesn't. I mean, I'm a millennial. I have student loan debt. I don't want to spend my precious dollars on something theoretical.
Okay. In a moment after our only break of the hour, I'll start working through some of the feedback that has come in via email. It's connections@wxxi.org, and I'll read some of your emails, your thoughts on the economy, the state of the market, the state of local jobs, and how you're feeling heading into 2019. You can also call the program toll-free if you like, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. But I understand why you'd rather email, because you're working. Everybody's working, luckily, right? That's okay. It's a bad economy joke. Annalise is Managing Director of GRE, Greater Rochester Enterprise. Ahmed Badabiel is a Professor of Economics at RIT, the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics there, and George Conboy is the Chairman of Brighton Securities. We're back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, a conversation about the impact of hate and intolerance. We sit down with local professors to discuss recent incidents of hate, lessons from history, and how the psychology of stereotypes and intolerance shape society. Then in our second hour, author Leslie Youngblood joins us in studio discussing her first novel, Love Like Sky, a remarkable book for young adults about blended families and more. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Roy emails the program to say, the U.S. population grew by 78 million people between, and he is citing, boy, January 1st, 2017, and the end of 2018? Our population grew by 78 million people? That can't be, right?
No, 78. No way.
But anyway, maybe Roy's got numbers mixed up, but he says, of course there are more homeless people. It's by percentage that matters, which is how we measure unemployment too. Also, what percentage of homeless people are actually looking for a home? Your guest mentioned that homeless people are having a hard time finding a home. Amit, that was you. Go ahead.
So what I was pointing out is that even though the unemployment numbers are at a record low, across the United States, homelessness has risen slightly. And when we look at those numbers, the numbers that I'm referring to are in percentage terms. I'm not talking about absolute numbers.
Not raw numbers, right.
That's right. So they are in percentage terms. So that's what I was referring to. Now, of course, the situation is somewhat more dire in very high-rent places like San Francisco, and they're significantly less dire in, say, much more affordable, Rochester. But the national trend is that it's slightly up, and those numbers, again, are percentage terms.
And that does correspond to what producer Megan Mack sends me from the National Alliance to End Homelessness. A rate of approximately 17 people experiencing homelessness on a given night per 10,000 people in the U.S. general population, up slightly since the beginning of 2016. So, just an interesting juxtaposition. If you see the economy, all of these ostensible gains, we do have a higher number of homelessness.
Yes, we do. It's a slight increase. The only caveat that I would add is that, you know, California is a big state, and so what happens in California matters. And we have a relatively unusual situation because of several natural disasters. A lot of people are temporarily homeless, mm-hmm. so that's spiking the numbers in a way that you would normally not see had there been no such disasters.
All right, let me get to your phone calls. Jack in Greece first up. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, questions I have. I haven't heard folks touch on this yet that I can recall, but with the dramatic decrease that we've had in taxes at the federal level, how that decrease in revenue is driving up our deficit and what that might do to our interest rates, the cost of goods. And at the same time, we're seeing the president's policy regarding tariffs and how also that tends to drive up costs here in our country. And that also, in my mind, would be a driver on inflation.
Okay.
I'd like to get folks' comments.
Yeah, Jack, thank you. A lot to work through there. I'm going to start with Anna and ask you if you think the question of tariffs will have a local impact.
I think, well, certainly manufacturers in the region that are engaged in international trade are paying very close attention to the issue. Being cautiously optimistic, I think that it's good for domestic manufacturing and will ultimately be good for Rochester area manufacturers, depending on the sector.
Okay. George Conboy, a lot to work through with the rest of his call there. Go ahead.
Yeah, in the markets, certainly tariffs have had a meaningful impact on stock prices, not because of effects on manufacturers, but because of presumed or expected effects on manufacturers. The actual effects, we haven't really seen yet in a meaningful way.
Okay. Professor Bonnabiel.
So what I would add is there are basically two effects that all tariffs lead to. So there is a revenue-raising requirement, but that's not really the focus right now. So tariffs make consumers worse in general, as long as they're buying the products upon which the tariffs have been laid, because the prices are now higher. And it helps the competitors of the industries or the sectors in which there are tariffs. So, for instance, you levy a tariff on, say, Chinese imports of textiles, domestic textile manufacturers benefit. So certain producers benefit, but consumers are in general hurt because prices rise. So that's very important to keep in mind. And in fact, there is some very recent research from the Tax Foundation that I've seen that the tariffs are beginning to have a much broader negative impact on the American economy, given that the tariffs have been in place for a while now. And I want to point out that, you know, President Trump's pet peeves with China, many of them are legitimate. I generally don't find myself in agreement with much of what he does, but I think in this case, it's legitimate. But tariffs are not the way to deal with the problem.
Well, the president says you're wrong.
Well, he is, of course, Mr. Tariff Man, as he proudly proclaimed in a tweet.
Well, he says
I'm not.
He's very smart. I want to get to Bob and Brighton in a second. I want to just hit one other point that Jack is raising, which is a growing government deficit, despite sort of the promises regarding the tax reform bill, we have a massive deficit. And I think it is fair to say, historically in the last 30 years in this country, if you are a Republican serving in the federal government, you care about deficits if Democrats are in power, and if Republicans are in power, you don't. I think that's basically been how it's gone. Dick Cheney basically said that when he was the vice president. But then the question becomes is, do we overstate the impact of deficits and the national debt anyway? George Conboy, do we care about the deficit and the debt?
Everyone cares about it. No one does anything about it. That's the story about the weather. Am I right?
Okay, fair.
We can support a large deficit. We can support large debt if the economy is healthy and growing. And we can't if it's not. I'm not happy that we have a growing deficit. As long as the economy keeps growing, we can deal with that. But there seems to be no political will on either side of the aisle for any meaningful reduction.
Okay, Professor?
I would agree with that.
Okay. Anna, you want to jump in on deficit?
No, not my area of expertise.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm more focused on the regional
economy.
She said,
keeping it regional here. Okay. let me get back to the phone then. And Bob in Brighton, Next up. Go ahead, Bob.
All right. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two points that I'd like to have explored. Number one, there was talking about the economy and its growth and how it's doing in terms of unemployment number. That 80% that the professor referenced aren't necessarily experiencing growth in the same way. Over time, what will that do to the economy? The other part of my question, or hope you'll discuss, mm-hmm. is I've heard about deficit and deficit and deficit. What I rarely hear about is the cause of the deficit, the largest cause, which, in my understanding, might be traced to endless war, among other things, and how that impacts the potential for a solid real economy as opposed to what the stock market is doing. Thanks.
Bob, thank you for the phone call. Professor, he referenced your earlier remarks. I'll let you follow up there. Go ahead.
Okay, so which part do you want me to
address? He talked about the 80%. What he's saying right. there is when you talk about the top 5%, 10%, right. 20% doing
right.
well,
right.
wages going up significantly, but the bottom 80% seeing very little wage growth.
Right. So basically the question is, what are the impacts of that?
Yes.
There are many, many impacts. But the most obvious impact is that our national economy is significantly driven by consumption. Consumption really boosts and adds a significant fillip to our national economy numbers in terms of growth, both levels and growth. So if people, or the 80% that he referenced, see virtually no wage gains, certainly compared to inflation, then they're not going to have any ability to consume because they have very little disposable income after inflation has been factored in. So if there is very little consumption, then the single biggest stimulant to the economy ceases to be a stimulant in the way that it has, and that's going to have a negative impact on aggregate economic activity.
And are you worried that that's what we're facing in the short and the long term right now?
Well, I'm worried that if this continues for many more years, wherein 80% of the population sees very little gains, then that's going to be a problem. Because even if the top 20% do well, you're seeing very, very large numbers of people, and now I'm talking about absolutely large numbers of people, who see no gains. And that has other impacts also, quite apart from the consumption related, in terms of how they choose to vote, where they live, what kind of candidates they elect, things of that sort.
All right, so Annalise, when you said the data indicates regionally, we track pretty well with nationally when it comes to wages, that, you know, we do have a significant number of new and growing companies and well-paying jobs, but we also probably have some stagnation at the lower levels, just like we see nationally. Does that concern you regionally? I mean, is this something that is on the radar? And do you have any thoughts on, you know, what it means for us here in Western New York?
Certainly. So drawing on Pittsburgh as an example, it was 2010 when Google made the decision to invest in one particular professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and that snowballed into, because of their robotics expertise, snowballed into Google, Uber, and several other high-tech companies making massive investments and growing the workforce there in Pittsburgh. And it transformed the city and the region from being, you know, Steel Town, USA, to a high-tech, very skilled economy. And housing prices went up drastically, wages went up drastically, and there was some displacement. So here in Rochester, we haven't seen that type of tremendous shift. I see it as being possible with our expertise in optics and photonics and imaging and food and beverage innovation. And were something like that to happen and a seismic shift take place in terms of average wages and cost of living, I think it would be disruptive in both very positive and quite negative ways. I don't see that happening in the very, very near term, but it's a possibility.
Okay. And just in terms of how that would happen, I think everyone was aware that the whole notion of the Amazon HQ2 thing was a long shot. Turns out, if you ask me, Washington and New York City. You did want to throw us a curveball. But look, a lot of cities put together bits, and I understand why. And that would have been a disruptive change. Mm-hmm. Apart from a big, big employer coming in, does disruptive change happen? Can it happen in sort of fits and starts? You know, a small to mid-size here and a small to mid-size there? Or does it take something transformative like an Amazon? It's not going to be Amazon here, but like that.
Well, 80% of our economic growth comes from existing businesses here in the region that are adding, you know, 36 jobs here, 100 jobs here, 20 jobs here.
Sure.
So, yes, it can move incrementally at a more glacial pace, and that's more likely than the big announcement. Even, you know, Amazon going to New York and D.C., it's going to be a big change, but it's not something that those markets can't handle. The big lesson we learned from HQ2 was that Amazon follows the talent, and so it sparked a broader discussion in Western New York, throughout the Finger Lakes region, into Syracuse about, you know, we have all of these amazing tier one research universities educating mm-hmm. tens of thousands of students every year. We want to retain more of those students. Some other markets, Columbus, Ohio being one of them, have done excellent work in terms of tracking percentage of graduates that are staying in the markets and keeping them there and growing those numbers. Philadelphia is another great example. They were losing a lot of Penn grads and Drexel grads to D.C. and New York, and they started to really strategically focus on it. So, you know, here in this market, we're trying to work collaboratively to keep more of that young talent here so that when the next big project is announced, we land on the shorter list.
So mm-hmm. in a sense, then, maybe I'm being too cynical about Amazon and the whole process.
I think so, yeah. I mean, it certainly...
sounds like there was a possible benefit to us.
Yeah, we learned a lot of lessons, and we also worked so collaboratively on our regional bid that we learned it was a great asset mapping project for us and a gap analysis. So we learned where are we doing well and where do we need to perform better.
Okay. George, anything you want to add there?
I've got nothing to add to that one.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and read
very
the...
Very thorough.
Can I make a point?
Oh,
there?
Sure. Go ahead, Professor.
So one thing that I wanted to add is that, you know, we have a certain number of superstar cities in the world, including in our own country. They don't need any help, you know. They are going to be superstar cities no matter what we do. But the issue of, you know, retaining a talented workforce, I think one thing that we don't look at enough in New York State is, yes, it's true that looking at, say, for instance, the Rochester region, many of RIT and U of R grads, they leave. They don't want to be here in the area immediately upon graduation. But if you follow them several years later, many of them do want to come back. But unfortunately, to the best of my knowledge, we don't quite have data on how many people leave for 7 to 8 years or something like that, but then eventually return.
Okay.
Because if that could be determined, then it would be a significant positive to, you know, face the naysayers with who say, well, we have this great difficulty retaining our graduates.
Sure.
Everybody wants to be here. High tax environment, blah, blah, blah. Well, many of them do, in fact, want to come back.
Anna, I saw you nodding there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I've been approached on multiple occasions to see if I have data about this boomerang effect, and we can speak anecdotally about it. We don't have the hard data, but we've talked to the colleges and universities in the region about tracking
right.
that information to the best of their ability. And also I'm noticing that LinkedIn has become more and more of a smart research tool in terms of you can track, you know, origins and destinations. And I have a whole list of RIT grads who are living out in Silicon Valley, and I can see, you know, when they move back to the Rochester region. So we're trying to track it. But again, it's anecdotal information more so than real numbers.
And maybe in the months and years to come, we'll get better data. You think so?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, I think as young talent moves into positions of higher leadership within companies, and there's more telecommuting opportunities out there in the economy, and people are starting families and wanting to invest in homes and live in more livable markets, especially climate-safe markets such as Rochester, Buffalo, you're going to see more and more of this boomerang effect.
Oh, I didn't know you were going to get political this hour.
Oh, no. Well, it's true. No real natural disaster risk. And, you know, if you look at some of the issues that they've dealt with in California, you know, none of that is...
Climate change is not political.
Rochester is no drama. It's a no drama town.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because I think the point there is really well taken. Rochester has become no drama weather town. And to that point, here's Pete emailing the program who says... Evan, I moved here about 5 years ago since my wife is from here and we wanted to be closer to family. I am also in the process of trying to move a medical device company to Rochester from Pennsylvania.
Hey, give me a call.
As a result of being from somewhere else, I see the local scene through a different set of eyes versus some of the longtime locals who are sometimes more cynical. He says, I see Rochester as being loaded with talent and nothing but opportunity. The cost structures, the lifestyle, culture, and ease of doing business except taxes is refreshing. People want to help and want to see things happen here. There is real value in how the community is evolving, intentionally or not, toward a post-Kodak and post-Xerox economy. I believe Rochester could realistically become something like the Austin, Texas of the North. In 5 years, I hope we are discussing how to manage all the growth versus what to do to stimulate growth. Yes, I'm an optimist, and I am bullish on Rochester. That is from Pete.
I like you, Pete.
Do you know who he is?
I do not, but Pete, my information is all over the internet. So get in touch if you need any help moving your business here. We'd love to cut through the red tape for you. I agree with all of Pete's remarks there. He's absolutely on point. It's just, you know,
his email came from your email address.
Oh, it did?
Yeah.
Oh, you're joking.
I'm
okay.
Kidding. No, I mean, that is as good an endorsement as you really can get for the region.
Yeah, and that was unsolicited.
I know.
So
no,
very much
really
appreciated.
Was.
And to his point, Rochester has been referred to as a best-kept secret. And, you know, as somebody who is only just recently becoming a homeowner myself, I'm glad that I bought in early versus waiting, you know, years for us to turn into the Austin, Texas of the North, when prices will be skyrocketing. You know, I want others to discover this gem of a region, but also it's kind of nice having a 20-minute commute.
How realistic is Austin, Texas of the North to you?
Well, very different economy and very different climate, obviously. I see us more as being the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania of the ever so slightly east. But with optics, photonics, and imaging as our one of our largest and growing sectors, and with that technology really baked into a lot of the growth emerging industries like autonomous driving, data science and data research, healthcare technology, I see there being the sky's the limit for that impact over time.
Okay. Now, there's an interesting flip side to the coin we're talking about with young people moving back or maybe they're staying. And that is that for years in our business, we deal with a lot of people who are a little older and nearing retirement or in retirement because wealth skews older. And what we would often see is someone would lose their job or retire and often quickly look to move to someplace more accommodating to a retirement lifestyle. Now we're seeing someone in their 50s, if there's a job change, staying in Rochester or even in their 60s, because the telecommuting you mentioned is allowing skilled people to stay here and get a different job, do it remotely, and not move out of Rochester. So we see it on both the younger and older scale.
All right, and I'll end the program with an email from the ubiquitous Andrew Brady from the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation and Conscious Capitalism's local chapter. He says, it's great to hear the list of so many companies expanding and doing well in Rochester. It's also undeniable that gains have been deeply unequal. I don't believe that the pockets of growth will be sustainable unless we have a more inclusive prosperity. He lists a number of companies that he thinks are doing that well, and he says, studies show that conscious capitalism companies also outperform on financial metrics. I'm wondering if the guests have thoughts on using conscious capitalism as workforce development and economic development strategy, and or if they know other best practices outside Rochester that we could bring here to help business participate and even lead a push toward true inclusive prosperity in Rochester. I'm going to start with Anna on that. I'll ask all of you to weigh in. Go ahead, Anna.
Certainly. And I know Andrew well, and I appreciate his insights. I would agree, just based on my own observations, that those companies here in the greater Rochester region that really have an outside focus and are committed to workforce development and supporting the region tend to do better. And it's not just because of, you know, fiscally they do better. It's because they get better PR. You get better press when you treat your employees right and you treat your community well and you're a good neighbor. So I'm more focused on just straight up business growth. I want to see more jobs created. And so that conscious capitalism piece tends to not be considered, you know, in the processes that we look at in economic development. But he makes a really excellent point.
Okay, George?
Conscious capitalism has always existed. It's never been universal, and it never will be, and it hasn't had a catchy name. But George Eastman and Henry Ford took care of their people well and paid them well, and they had good workforces and produced decent products in their own context. The same is true today. Companies that take care of their customers and take care of their employees will prosper, and that's conscious capitalism.
Well, I'll pivot for the last minute to Professor Badabiel. There's this idea that some have, and I think we're going to see in the Democratic primaries and the presidential race to see just where the party is going, that this is capitalism's like moment in this country to either stay or go. And that, I mean, that sounds apocalyptic, but certainly on the left, that conversation is happening. Is inclusive prosperity possible and more universal under sort of a capitalistic system here?
Is it possible? The answer is yes. Is it inevitable? The answer is no. Because what we need to understand is that just as capitalism has been famous, rightly so, for having created unprecedented wealth throughout not just the United States but elsewhere in the world, there is a seamier side to capitalism. And because there is the seamier side to capitalism, we need, robust regulatory enforcement to make sure that the capitalism that is actually on display is what we in fact want. And the specific aspect of that, I'd like to highlight is the tendency for scale economies to work and make certain operations very, very big. Now, in the tech realm, Amazon, Google, Microsoft come to mind. So when you get very, very big, there's a natural tendency to look at what's narrowly best for you and sometimes to forget what's good for the constituents that you are serving. And that's where vigorous regulatory enforcement is needed to make sure that these very big players do in fact take everybody and not just themselves into account.
Thank you for the email, Andrew. I didn't have time. I was going to ask George Conboy to predict the number of the Dow 12 months from today. I'll just ask you, the Dow or one Bitcoin will be a higher number?
The Dow will be a higher number.
And George is going, thank you for the easy one to finish out.
The softball.
The chairman of Brighton Securities, thank you for being here as always, George. Thanks to Anna List, managing director of the Greater Rochester Enterprise. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you, Evan.
And thank you to Amit Badabial, a professor of economics at RIT. Always appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.